had a dream about this place.
So, next up, we'll talk about deaths of particular interest throughout the Brahman Killers case. There are notable people who have been killed, or were murdered, or were thought to be, you know, they were killed for a particular reason, or a particular
interest. Yeah, they were
targeted. A target was the word I was looking for, yes. And so, the first one we can start with is Léon Finet. As we've mentioned previously, he was the informant of Venayan, relating to the coup, the Blue Operation, Operation Blue, that was supposed to take place in 1973. And back then, he was actually a member and a director of Banque Copine, which is a private bank, I believe, that was dealing with private funds and all that. And also he was involved, you know, in all sorts of Belgian underworld activities, like arms dealing. And, you know, he was a financier actually of illegal arms sales, both to Israel and Arab countries, Lebanon as well, I believe, which is like a recurring theme in the Brahman Killers, which is really weird. The fact that, you know, you have these sort of, Lebanese and like, Middle Eastern interests or, you know, dealings that keep popping up throughout this. In 1980, he told Venayan that, you know, there was this coup that was supposed to happen in 1973 that kept gaining weight again. And that was bound to happen because, you know, you've had all the big names we've mentioned, like Mondon Bouillonnance, Bourrir, Militis, all that, you know, they were at it. That's pretty much it about this guy, you know. So it seems he was in the known about things. He was very much also I don't know if you say this in English. Like, he brought money to the gendarmerie to use in like some drugs deal operations. Like, you know, they needed like cash very quickly that they couldn't get from gendarmerie, you know, like just withdraw from the accounts. So he would like get the cash from the bank and then bring them to the gendarmerie. He worked with Robert Beyer. Yeah. So Beyer tells about it in his book, I believe, or like he talked about it at least, and he said that you know, he was the one that was bringing the drug unit of the gendarmerie the money they needed for some operations, and Beyer dealt with him, you know, like face to face.
That is very interesting when you think about the mess around the Francois affair and how they were constantly robbing Peter to pay Paul and whatnot. And just to add as well, couple of other details as well. So he was also a SEPIC member as well. So that put him in the same sort of broad right-wing firmament as Paul Vanden Buenans and all the rest of it. And the bank that he was a director of, we're going to talk about that a bit more later on, because that also is suspected to have played a role in the Brabant Killers attacks. Mm-hmm. I found a quote actually from his daughter, and she was asked to give her thoughts on 1985, which is this amazing TV show that came out last year, which is about the Brabant Killers attacks. And she was asked what she thought about the implication that somehow that attack in Overijse was actually a disguised assassination of her dad? I mean, it's quite a question to ask someone, I suppose. And yeah, she said, well, she wasn't overly sold on the idea. She said that, yeah, he lived in Overijse, which was 2 kilometers from Dale Hayes, the supermarket they attacked. He bought his newspaper there every day. Although it has been pointed out that 8 o'clock at night is a strange time to be buying a newspaper for that day.
Yeah.
And then she goes on to say, it is true that he was talking all the time about that coup and also about a certain colonel. That always came back. The colonel said this. The colonel said that. Who was that colonel? I have no idea. So yes, he was in the middle of the world you see now in 1985. But if someone was specifically trying to kill him, couldn't that person also be waiting for him in front of his house?
Yeah, yeah. But also is the idea of the, I forgot what it's called. There's a term in Italian to refer to it. I think maybe you might know it, where you hide a murder in a spree of murders. Like the attack on Overijse, they killed, I believe, 8 people. I'm not sure. I won't say for sure, but they killed a bunch of people, including Léon Finet. So he wasn't the only one that was targeted, you know. And exactly because of that, you know, that's the reason why they did it there. Because if they did it in front of his house, it would have been an obvious hit, you know. Like someone came up to him and like shot him. And there, you know, if they did it that way, you know, there's, of course, you know, the people are still going to look in his past and dig up some things, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, the first thing the police and the gendarmerie will think about, will look into won't be Finet, you know, they will try to understand why they hit the Deleuze. So I think actually that like brings more substance to the targeted assassinations theory. Is that, you know, it would be hit there. But also, you know, she's been through a lot, his daughter, you know, she's been speaking out very publicly against the malfunctions in the Ankara's investigation. She co-wrote a book with the administrator of the Brabant Killers Forum, Michel Lurquin, in 2014, I believe. There was a new edition that came out this year, where she wrote some sort of like outro to the book, you know, and where she talks about the what she dealt with the investigation, you know, and how hard it was to, you know, just come home one day and hear that your dad was like shot down in some sort of like terrorist attack or something. It's just very strange as well how the gendarmerie behaved with Léon Finet, is that, you know, they went on to visit his house to try and find things there. They stole documents there, I believe. Also, he had 2 dogs. So that's the house, you know, 2 kilometers away from Deleuze. While they were visiting, they found out that he had 2 dogs because he was living alone, I believe. And they basically shut down the dogs because, you know, they were a liability. They didn't even like bother to mention the family that, you know, they could take the dogs away or something. They didn't call his daughter. Like, they just shut the dogs and left them for dead there. Her story is really touching, you know. It's and still to this day, she's one of the people, you know, keeping that sort of spirit alive, you know, to hopefully get some answers one day from the Belgium state about the Brabant killers.
The next pair of murders is possibly the weirdest aspect of this, which I mean, I'll let you sort of give us the details, but basically this is the couple that was murdered in Colruyt, outside the Colruyt, and this was Elise DeWitt and Jacques Forêt. Now they were both SEPIC members, and there's a lot of talk that actually they were targeted and murdered, and then sort of after the fact the Brabant killers pretended to rob this store to disguise what had actually been going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and sure enough, the cops took the bait and they said that, oh, well, this couple must have disturbed the gang while they were in the process of committing a crime. Mm. But yeah, Nick, break this down for us because this is a very weird one.
So yeah, it's quite long, I think. Like, I'll go on a whole tangent, but like, there's a lot of details about this. So first up is that the, you know, when this happened, so 17 September 1983, like you said, the global suspicion of the gendarmes when they came on the scene was that the couple came to the... So, okay, I'll get into the details. There was a gas station in front of the Colruyt. That's where the couple pulled up. The Colruyt was actually in the back, rather, you know, so like the gas station is on the side of the road. Then you've got the Colruyt in the back, a few hundred meters away. Mm-hmm. And that's where the Brahmin kiddos were, you know, they were cutting a hole through one of the doors of the Colruyt to get through and steal some stuff, which they were in the middle of, apparently, when they assaulted the couple. And so there's this whole thing, like, you know, were they trying to, you know, were they waiting for the couple, or were they trying to make it look like they were doing the, you know, the robbery while they were waiting for the couple? Because the thing that happened is when they pulled to get gas at the gas station, these guys just came out of nowhere, basically, and like started grabbing them, and they shot them for dead, like, immediately, and they left some like some signature killings. You know, there was, I believe, the usual shots to the head that we've seen a couple times in the Brahmin Killers, and also I think Jacques' pants were brought down. Don't quote me on that, but I think there was some sort of that. What I'm sure is that Elise had some a pants as well, like were messed with, and she was brought. They took the corpse, you know, by the legs. They dragged them to hide behind the shopping caddies of the store. So like they moved the corpse and they were doing some weird stuff with it. Not sure if these are supposed to be, you know, indications of the hit, or if these are just coincidence. Now, what's also interesting, before getting into the whole of it, is that there were also testimonies about how actually on the highway where the couple pulled from, you know, to get to the gas station, they were followed upon by a black or like a dark car, signaling to be a police car with like some blue lights on it or something, and mm-hmm. that they, you know, instructed the couple to pull over to the side of the highway and, you know, to just like follow up on. And that's interesting because then the couple could have been like forced to pull to the gas station and to, you know, where the Brahmin Killers were waiting to be then shot. Because we don't know for sure why they pulled to the gas station, because they had the tank wasn't full, but it was like enough for them to get home.
Yeah.
So there's no real reason for them to stop, especially there where the Brahmin Killers are planning a hit. You know, there's some like lots of coincidence there. But we can't quite say for sure. Now, what's interesting, the tick of that story is that in the Ben Van Nevel file, so the Brahmin Killers file, there was a note that was added by the BSR of WAF that we've talked about, you know, the one that was looking into far right and all sorts of other leads. And apparently there was, you know, some sort of weird story about construction magnate called Charlie de Pau in Brussels. And he had ties to victims of the gang of Nevel, so the Brahmin Killers. Now, Charlie de Pau is a business, he's a member of the business lobby around VDB, you know, he's one of his usual guys. He's the guy who got chosen to build the World Trade Center in Brussels, I believe. That was like one of the major construction projects in Brussels at the time in the 70s and the 80s. He was very rich as well. And, you know, he was in sort of that political aristocratic circle around VDB. And then, you know, in that PV, so that's like that police file record, shows that there was a mention of a tape, you know, a compromising video cassette of Charlie de Pau, you know, that was recorded in La Hulpe. Now, La Hulpe is a private villa at the Belgian coast that was like notorious for being used to host sex parties, if not pink bullets, you know, so yeah. That's the kind of stuff. So when there's mention of a compromising videotape, you know, first thought is pink bullets. And apparently, Charlie de Pau had gotten his hands on it. So he was on it, you know, and he wanted to get his hands on this, which he did by paying 140 million francs to get a cassette back. And apparently that cassette was in the hands of the couple, Elise DeWitt and Jacques Fourier. Now, to, you know, link all that back, Jacques Fourier and Elise DeWitt were SEPIC members. So like that's the same circle as Charlie Depau. He's not SEPIC directly, but, you know, Paul van den Boeyenans is the president of SEPIC in the PSC. So it's, you know, it's all linked together. It sort of makes sense. And and so I think, you know, the thinking was that this couple had gotten their hands on this compromising cassette, and they were blackmailing Depau with it, you know, saying to him, like, you've got to pay this outrageous amount to us, or else we'll, you know, we'll make sure this tape gets in the right hands.
So just to try and sort of nail down the chain of custody, because it does get very confusing, this story about the cassette. So
absolutely, yeah.
The cassette originally is made at this villa where these sex parties take place. And then did they ever identify the blackmailer who is supposed to have sold the tape to Depau?
There's no. It was like sort of this, you know, practice that was common in those circles, that do in Pignon Affair and the Pink Ballets, which is like basically everybody, or like almost everybody, the guys in the known at least, were either recording or, you know, known that this was being recorded, so acted upon that. But there's no mention of that, so there's no real, like, it's, I have to say, it's not like as defined, you know, there's no like incriminating evidence about all this, you know, but like it sort of like all links up to relations and stuff like that.
Yeah. So so to go back to like the chain of custody, so the blackmailers get in touch with Charlie Depau. They sell him the tape back for 140 million francs.
No. I think that's where I might have been confused. Is that apparently the blackmailer had the couple had gotten the tape of the blackmailer
before
selling it to Depau.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So right. Okay. I'll do that again then. Right. So,
yeah. Sorry. I wasn't very.
No. No worries. Right. So chain of custody is this tape gets made. A blackmailer or blackmailers has the tape, and then this couple who move in the same SEPIC business circles as Charlie Depau and Paul van den Boeyenans and all these people who go to these parties, they then somehow get hold of the tape from the blackmailers.
Yeah.
This is the theory anyway. And they are the ones who say they'll sell it back to Charlie Depau for 140 million francs. And then the couple are presumably in possession of this tape on the night that they are killed. The theory is that it's in the boot of their car. This is all kind of like the speculation and the theories that were doing the rounds at the time. When these links between the Brabant killers and the Pignon affair and whatnot began to emerge.
Now, what was interesting with the couple is that they were also thought of to be participating in some of these Pignon parties and some of these Pink Ballets. So, you know, they would be very much in the known of incriminating evidence or, you know, tapes. And that's how they will get their hands on the tape ultimately. The story is that, you know, they had gotten an advance on that money from Depau. They had gone to Paris, you know, to have some sort of, because they were on the way back from Paris when they were killed, to have some sort of like of celebration. They were planning to buy, I think it was like some sort of little cabin in the woods, in the Ardennes woods in Belgium, that cost a lot of money that they didn't really have, you know, on their hands. So there's some sort of like, you can wonder where they got that money at. And then, you know, all of a sudden they pull up to that gas station and they get killed, like violently assassinated. And that's where the gang would have took the video cassette from the trunk of the car, the Mercedes.
Yeah, right. And not too long after this, Charlie Depauw died anyway. I think it was of natural causes, yes. But I've never found exactly what it was. But he'd been treated in America for like an ongoing health complaint and then really quickly deteriorated and died. I don't think there's anything suspicious around that, is there? It does seem like it's legit.
There isn't. No, it was quite... I don't know his age, but I know he was quite old by 1984. Yeah,
and pretty sick.
He was in his 60s or 70s, yeah.
Yeah. Although, I do know that Guy Goffignon, who we've talked about before, he ordered an investigation into the circumstances of Charlie Depauw's death because he wasn't entirely sure that it was above board, like it was a natural death.
Yeah.
And I think he may have also chased up aspects of this video cassette rumor.
Yeah, yeah. It was followed up on, but like, there was like nothing ever official came out of it, you know, but it was followed up on.
Yeah. But and there's a note as well, actually.
Yeah,
it was inserted into a file that was built by the BOB of Wavre. They said that they'd heard tell as well from their informants that Charlie Depauw had allowed himself to be blackmailed. They put it as allowed himself to be blackmailed for 140 million francs. So I don't know if this means that it was accepted practice in those circles that you could expect to be blackmailed at some point if you went to one of these parties and it was just the cost of doing business. I don't know. But again, very little follow-up on that note. It's just a very strange footnote in this file as a whole.
Yeah. And before getting into another detail about that tape, there's also something I want to touch on. It gets a bit... you know, a lot of people to keep up with AA, but basically when the Colruyt, the Neville Colruyt, it happens, later on in the investigation, the investigators think the people responsible for this hit are this gang called the Borin gang, that come from like the south of Belgium. Turns out they weren't involved at all. But, you know, some of these members had admitted to being present at Nivelle, you know, either to, like, keep guard or to drive a car or something like that. And, you know, when you think about it, if all sort of, like, global working theory about various people being used to do various hits, you can think of it in terms of, like, having two squads at Nivelle, you know. So you've got the Bremenkiller's guys, the real guys, you know, the big guns, they're there to shut down that couple. And then you've got the Borin gangs, you know, that's in the back, sort of like cutting down the corridor and all that, you know, pretending to steal groceries and, you know, some cash in money from the store. So, you know, it would have worked like some sort of tandem, you know, some sort of duo of criminals there to ensure that this all worked and that there was a trail, you know, because they were acquitted later on the Borin's gang, but they were also thought of to be part of these, some of these hits for quite long. And even though they were beaten to admit that they were part of it, there were some details, you know, about the case that they couldn't have known if they weren't at least in the some sort of broader knowledge of, you know, the Bremenkiller's. So yeah, there's something there, maybe, you know, some sort of like old switcheroo between the gangs, or like trying to lead the investigators through the Borin's gang. I don't know, you know, it's all, that's the thing, you know, is that there's a lot of theories to make about all this, but ultimately there's no, you know, smoking gun to say that happened for sure. Yeah.
I suppose as well, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that it is extremely strange that a couple with ties to this right-wing business and political elite just so happened to be at this gas station that night and are murdered by the Brabant killers, given there are all of these very strange, unnerving connections between the Brabant killers operation and said right-wing business and political milieu. But we'll get into more about that later.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I found these whole branching threads of intrigue and inquiry, and there's like Guy Matheux named Van den Boonans again. There's various members of like the SEPIC and Brussels business community that are also mentioned, and it sort of all revolves around the existence or not of this videotape and how this may have been the reason for this couple getting killed. But it is interesting following these threads, in as much as even if you can't find anything concrete connecting Charlie Depau and this couple to the existence of this cassette tape, you find these very interesting links anyway, which, you know, they take you to all sorts of places, like the Societe Generale. There's a lot of like strange financial voodoo that's going on there. Adnan Khashoggi was supposed to be friendly with like Charlie Depau and VDB. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps going on. These very weird connections keep popping up.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I can go on with the story if you want. Mm-hmm. There's a story about the tape. So there was, you know, in the 80s, an article that was supposed to come out in, I won't say which publication because I don't remember. It was written by a Flemish reporter, and actually he got refused. That story didn't go through, and so he leaked it to the internet years later on the Ramen Killers forum, and various people, including the administrator of the forum, were, you know, able to check that he was, you know, a real reporter, not just some guy, you know, posting that stuff. And so the story would go is that, you know, there were talks about that tape, you know, in the 80s, and they were trying to get their hands on the tape, the whole VDB circle. So that's Brussels, that's the SEPIC, that's PSC and all that. So I'll try and be brief, and I'll try to, you know, make sense most of the time. But there's a lot of names that people might not be familiar with, but there's some interesting threads that this leads to. So one of the strongest politicians in Brussels at the time that was very familiar with Charlie Depau was Philippe Moreau. He was the socialist that was gone to be mayor of one of the communes in Brussels, I believe. And one day in the early 80s, I think it's 1981 or 1982, there's no date mentioned in the article, he was driving from Brussels to a villa in Liège with three army vets by his side. And they were going to the house of Georges Siwi, which was a local businessman who turns out to be an arms dealer. And they're there to pick up something. You know, they're going to his house. It's at night. And they, you know, they pull up to the house, to the villa, and they're looking around. And they get out of the car. They walk to the front door, and they're looking at the doorbell. The guy opens his door and says, like, hey, what are you guys doing here? You know, they just run away. They get back in the car and then they drive back to Brussels.
That's a hilarious image.
That's like Looney Tunes level. Yeah, that's Looney Tunes level stuff.
So presumably they thought that there was going to be nobody at home. They were going to try and break in.
That's right. The thinking, yeah. And they were trying to break in to look for something, presumably the tape. That was linked to Charlie Depau, which is why Moreau was going there, because he was a friend of Depau. You know, they go back to the villa a second time, this time with Guy Matteau's girlfriend. So Guy Matteau is another minister, you know, was named frequently in the pink ballots. He was part of VDB's government in the 70s. He was a socialist, but, you know, he was like hanging in that like circle of VDB, very influenced by him and his friends, including Depau. So, you know, all those people knew each other. So Moreau knew Matteau, who knew Depau, who knew VDB. They were all familiar with them, with each other, really. And so Depau also, like you said, was familiar with quite a bunch of other arms dealers, like Adnan Khashoggi and Akram Oije, which I believe was a Saudi arms dealer, which goes to raise a couple of questions, you know, like why were these, Brussels construction magnates in talks with these arms dealer. Why was he going on this expedition for a friend of his to look for a tape, you know, incriminating tape into the context of the pink ballots?
Also, just to remind listeners as well, as with Juan Mendez, this is the early 80s. This is Belgium. And this is a bunch of arms dealers, sort of all interlinked with each other, cutting deals. And we know that the enterprise arms smuggling deal was being set up at this time. We already know that Juan Mendez was connected to Iran-Contra.
Yes.
Adnan Khashoggi was as well. So now we can start thinking about the truly, I guess, global dimensions of the Belgian X-Files when you actually begin to add in the names of the people just in Belgium who were also connected to major players in Iran. Contra, and this idea of arms trafficking being sort of a major factor in the Brabant Killers hits, as well as, you know, like the Pink Ballets and whatnot, starts to make a lot more sense why people keep returning to that subject.
Right, right. That's like the broader view, because this is like you've just explained, you know, all of this really links back to the Brabant Killers with the arms dealing and all that.
Yeah.
So, the second time Moreau goes to the villa in Liège is with the girlfriend, well, the friend of Guimato, which is this, they refer to her as an hostess, which is basically, she was a prostitute that Mato fell in love with, and that he would bring around, you know, without their relationship being official. And she asked the key to the house, which is quite strange, but apparently, you know, they knew what they were doing. If she was there with the key, they get inside, they search everywhere for something, you know, but they can't find it. And, you know, the thing that makes most sense for them to be searching was this tape.
Yeah.
Which is, what the Poe was really afraid of, you know, leaking, and why he was willing to pay so much money to get it back, and why he would hypothetically would be willing to, you know, order a hit on the couple that would later get their hands on the tape. There's a later on Moreau, so it was the guy that drove back to that villa, you know, to check for that tape. He would be a question in the André Cool's murder scandal that would happen a few years later. And he told the cops something interesting about those trips to that villa, is what he said. I'm quoting him directly. I remember a conversation with André Cool, who told me that Guimato, Minister of Public Works at the time, was in trouble following threats from his friend, Von Vreckham. So that's the prostitute he was friend with, well, his girlfriend, sort of. After I spoke with her in the presence of an army general, Von Vreckham told us that there was a compromising videotape for Van den Boeyenens and his entourage. According to her, this cassette was located in a villa near Liège, more precisely in Saint-Tilmont. We went there. Von Vreckham had the key. There was no one in the house, but we found no tape or documents. So remember, that's Moreau saying this, you know, to the police. So he's admitting that, you know, there was a tape they were looking for. And you can make the link to the Poe when he mentions VDB's entourage, because that's like his, you know, one of his guys.
Yeah, it seems like anytime that comes up, like if people say VDB's circle, VDB's entourage, everyone knows who exactly that is referring to. I find it really interesting as well that, I mean, these aren't like low-level street criminals or something. Do you know what I mean? These are all fairly, surface, respectable members of Belgian business and political life. And they're there just glibly admitting, we broke into a guy's house, you know. What's the big deal? I was with a fucking army general when I broke into a guy's house looking for a videotape. Right. Well, it's insane. No big deal, you know.
Jesus.
Loosen up, man.
Thank you.
this is where I believe, like, the there's, you know, it goes in all kind of ways. There's more talk of the tape after, but I can also talk about Siwi, the guy whose villa was searched, you know, the guy who owned the villa. So, like I said, he was a sort of secret arms dealer, as in he was a respectable businessman as a front. But then, you know, he was dealing with arms, basically, and defense and all that. He was doing that in the shadows, despite working with the Belgian army. He had been also a rep for Israeli weapon manufacturers in the 70s. He was specialized in radar and electronic devices for the army. So he started out like importing US and Israeli device to Belgium before, you know, being hired by the Belgian army. So Belgian army 70s was in charge of the defense, national defense in 70s. That's Van den Boeyemans. And he gets in direct contact with the Israeli manufacturers to, you know, bring some of that technology to Belgium and to serve in the army. And that's not the only link he has with Van den Boeyemans, that guy, Siwi. He was also apparently, you know, some sort of like, he had some sort of working relationship with VDB, and he asked him to, you know, skip his compulsory military service that he was supposed to serve in the 70s, and VDB put in a good word, so, you know, he avoided that. And like I said, yeah, basically, you know, he was running that official arms deal with Belgium in the 70s when VDB was the defense minister, basically overseeing the armies and the gendarmerie. And, you know, he was on the side doing deals with, I suppose, you know, some all sorts of shady Israeli weapons manufacturers. And one funny coincidence is that the his girlfriend was a friend of the prostitute that Matteo had fell in love with, that he was bringing around, that had the key to his house, which is why, you know, all this sorts of link back up, because all these people knew each other, really. And he talks also of that girl, Van Vrekom, being used being hired to serve in special parties, you know. And so, yeah, that's when it starts all making sense. You know, it's a bit like maybe we can take a look back and maybe try to make some sense of all of this. But, you know, in the end, it only makes sense, you know, that this would be the outcome of it. Like, all these people knew each other. These people were holding special parties. There was blackmail involved. Some people tried to blackmail each other, and they were looking for a way to get out of that, you know, which I think and then it links back to the Poe tape. And, you know, it sort of all makes sense.
Think about how complex that line of inquiry is, all the different...
I hope
that was great, you know, man. So. It's just, I mean, by its very nature, this stuff is incredibly complicated and sort of hard to follow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was great because, yeah, it's really hard to get your head around the sheer dimensions of a lot of this stuff. But they aren't even the only deaths that have raised eyebrows. So we've already mentioned Juan Mendez, who I think I said to you, I'm going to consider that part of my own Brabant killers canon now, his murder.
Yes.
But there's also Jacques Van Kamp. He was killed on the 2nd of October, 1983, in a Brabant killers hit. He was also a SEPIC member. He owned the restaurant Trois Canards, and he was he was on really good terms with the couple, the Colroy couple who were murdered, Flores and DeWitt. They were very frequent customers at his restaurant, and he's also supposed to have been implicated in the Pink Ballets, is Van Kamp. So you've got Paul Van den Boeyemans, Jean-Paul Dumont, Fernand Breuillet, and there's someone else as well. There's a pimp. And there was a pimp called Oliver Castillo, I think he was called. They're supposed to have been frequent customers at Van Kamp's restaurant. They got on with him really, really well. He gets killed. There's another guy called Jan Palsterman. I hope I'm saying that right. He was pretty good friends and business colleagues with Leon Finet. He was killed on the 9th of November, 1985, which is interesting.
Absolutely.
And then, as we mentioned before, Bruno van Deuren, who was shot to death before he could appear before the gang commission and tell them what he knew about the links between the Brabant killers, the business class of Belgium, and the pink ballets. So, oh, and arms trafficking as well. Right. Can't forget that. So, yeah, it's quite a tangled web we're weaving here, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah. And we've even mentioned a couple of these suspect deaths in the previous episode, like with Asterix and a few others as well. And like you've said, it's quite a complex web. And it goes all the way from politicians to arms dealer to criminals to petty criminals.
It also goes to downtown Manhattan on September the 11th, 2001. But I will explain. I'll explain where that comes from in a little bit. And thus ends the second installment of our Brabant Killers Aftermath episodes. Usually we go quite a bit longer, but I'm hopeful you'll understand why it's best to listen to this one in isolation. Lots of names, lots of connections, lots of details that will become even more relevant later on. Next time, we are going to conclude the Brabant Killers mini-series with a look at the various theories that have been proposed over the years in an attempt to explain the violence that occurred in Belgium between 1982 and 1985. And then we are going to tie up this part of the series by discussing what became of some of the major players in the events that we've been describing. Next installment of Aftermath will be out probably Wednesday or Thursday next week. Hope you can join us for that one. And of course, as ever, check the sight lines, mark the exits, and don't get captured.